The partnership the U.S. has with Mexico on intelligence cooperation could be in jeopardy. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Intelligence cooperation between Mexico and the United States has become closer in the last decade on issues important to both countries: illegal immigration, border security, drugs, and human trafficking. But that critical intelligence relationship may be under examination in Mexico. The country is trying to fashion a response to a number of economic threats issued by the new Trump administration. Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Matalon reports.
This audio is the sound of Mexican Marines breaking into a compound and capturing Chapo Guzman last year. Guzman's the alleged drug trafficker and killer, extradited to the U.S. just last month. After Guzman was taken in, the DEA released a statement. The arrest is a significant achievement, they said, in our shared fight against organized crime. There are published reports that U.S. intelligence on Guzman's whereabouts led to the takedown. But will this kind of intelligence sharing continue?
There will be no incentives to collaborate with the United States.
No incentives to collaborate. That's Guillermo Valdez. He led Mexico's National Intelligence Agency between 2007 and 11. During his time in office and afterwards, intelligence collaboration deepened. Agents from both countries now work together on Mexico's southern border with Guatemala to stop U.S.-bound migrants. The DEA is active inside Mexico, and the U.S. Border Patrol is training Mexican border police inside the country. But Valdez says that relationship may fray some if a suite of economic threats against Mexico are carried out by the U.S.
If Mexico decides to slow the cooperation in security issues, the United States will be hurt.
Mexico's new foreign secretary, Luis Videgaray, recently told a television host that his country will only bend so far. He said Mexico won't play ball on U.S. requests if it's threatened.
Mexico está dispuesto a decir que no cuando el orgullo nacional, la dignidad nacional, se ven amenazadas.
Mexico is willing to say no when national pride and dignity are threatened, he said. Guillermo Valdez says Mexico should consider expelling DEA agents should the U.S. impose a border tax on Mexican goods or expand the border wall.
The belief that they can make a safe border with a wall, that's a false idea. That's not true, and they know.
Then Valdez says, put yourself in the shoes of a Mexican agent.
If I see that U.S. government now is attacking Mexico, I will not be enthusiastic about doing a good job to stop, for example, drugs going to the United States.
Valdez worked with American agents after Mexico's previous president, Felipe Calderón, went to war against Mexican drug cartels in 2006, a strategy backed by the U.S. A decade later, Valdez believes Mexico can withdraw support on any number of security fronts.
Or the stop of destroying plantations of amapola.
That's the poppy seed that makes heroin.
Poppy seed, yes. Or stopping collaboration with the DEA agents in exchange of information about drug traffickers.
One of the people Valdez worked closely with is the former deputy director of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, David Shedd.
I think the effects will be seen very quickly.
Shedd told me that when the U.S. deports someone to Mexico, the U.S. needs Mexican confirmation of that person's identity. Shedd isn't so sure Mexico will continue to furnish that information.
They may just sit on it or may not pursue it. These are very fluid and ongoing conversations that go on every day and every hour of the day between our two countries.
Which Shedd says took a decade to get going.
And I just wouldn't want to see that decreased as a result of a tone that really puts the Mexicans on edge.
Again, Guillermo Valdez.
It's better to cooperate and not to fight.
He says Mexico isn't just looking for criminal kingpins. His colleagues are also working to stop migrants from what Mexico calls restricted nationalities, places where terrorism is prevalent.
People who come from countries with the presence of Al-Qaeda or ISIS.
That cooperation could come to an end, he says. But he's hopeful that a security relationship that's taken decades to build won't be weakened, despite the words of a new American administration. I'm Lorne Matalon.
The Department of Homeland Security issued new rules this week that allow more and faster deportations of undocumented immigrants. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents are directed to expedite removals of any undocumented person convicted of any criminal offense, including minor ones, such as driving without a license. ICE agents also have authority to conduct more raids. Meanwhile, as President Donald Trump unveils a second version of his travel ban on refugees and immigrants, people caught up in the confusion of the first executive order are still trying to get over the experience. California student Sarah Yarjani, an Iranian national, is a permanent resident of Austria. She has a student visa in the U.S., but late last month she was turned away at the Los Angeles airport as the president's first travel ban went into effect. She spoke with Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS about being sent home and how she still has faith in the American people.
You were coming back from visiting your family in Austria. What happened when you landed at LAX?
I landed at around 8:30 and I was going to go through the normal passport control, which on other trips had been really quick, just a few questions. And the officer who was checking the passport, after asking me the normal questions to ask, told me that I have to wait for secondary. And another officer came and escorted me to a waiting area in the back. There was a lot of confusion and waiting in between. There was officers going back and forth. And it was all very harsh and fast orders, one after the other. And without any breathing time or anything in between to understand what's even going on. And an officer came after a while, took me to a room where he said that he was my caseworker. He had to do an interview. At the end of that, he said that you are not admissible to the U.S. and we will be sending you back. And he said, you now have two options. Either you agree to leave voluntarily and you sign a document saying so, or we will forcibly remove you, in which case you will be faced with a ban of 1 to 5 years or longer of reentry to the U.S. Will you comply? And I said, if you're telling me to, I will. And it wasn't presented like a choice. It was basically he was saying either we're sending you off anyway, either you leave voluntarily or we force you. And with everything that was going on, everything was so strangely harsh, and I felt that I had no choice other than saying that I agree and I comply. And after that, I was there for I had to wait 23 hours before they put me on a flight back.
Meanwhile, the ACLU of Southern California got involved, and you were able to return to the U.S. about a week later. Were you nervous about coming back to the U.S.?
Yes, I was, because the first time that I was here, it was 18 hours of traveling when I got here. I was detained here for 23 hours. There was, for most of that, there was hardly any food. There was crackers and juice and water. They had like noodles, which I couldn't have because of I was vegetarian, and the only thing available was chicken cup of noodles. So for 18 hours, I couldn't have any food. There was nothing else. And the way we were being treated was very harsh. And so when I was coming back, when there was the new ruling that said it was temporarily possible to enter and come back, I was really scared because I didn't know what would happen once I landed.
Well, you were admitted back into the United States.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The Trump administration now says it's working on a streamlined version of its travel ban, which reportedly won't affect people with approved visas. Would you feel comfortable about traveling back and forth from the U.S. if that went into effect?
I don't exactly know what is going to be set as the new regulations, but I've generally become very almost scared of going to the airport. Even when I was after that, when I arrived back here, my sister had flown in from Portland to see me. And when I wanted to just see her off at the airport for her to leave, I was feeling a bit anxious about even going to the airport to drop her off, because everything was happening was so irrational and it didn't make any sense. So I wasn't feeling safe enough because I didn't know. So I've generally been cautious about traveling.
Polls have shown that about half the people in the U.S. support some form of stricter vetting and tighter security for people coming into the country. Although you got caught up in it, do you think there's a need for tighter security controls?
The way that me and others were being treated and the way it was happening, I mean, when I was there, there was, with the flights arriving, there was women, children, older people, sick people. And even for me as a young, healthy person, it was very difficult to go through that. So I think with any security measures, I really feel that people being treated in such inhumane ways can be avoided. And I just hope that people I feel that there can be security without the things that happened in the last weeks happening to people who are innocent and pose no threat.
Has what you experienced a few weeks ago made you rethink how you feel about this country?
In that week between being deported and coming back, another thing which happened was that me and my family received so much support from people here. So from both emails, social media, there was so much words of support and people offering to help. I mean, I had the help of the ACLU lawyers, but there was other lawyers just contacting me saying that we've heard about your case, how can we help? There was people that none of us knew saying, how can we help with different things? Do you need a place to stay in the places where you're flying back to? Do you need anything? And there was really thousands of messages online and so many emails. And for me, that's the true American people, and that for me is what I know of America. And so I still feel the same way I've had about the American people, which in this weeks, I've also seen so much kindness and support from them.
That was Maureen Kavanaugh of KPBS talking with Sara Yarjani, an Iranian national with a student visa in the U.S. Even if you aren't from one of the countries listed in President Donald Trump's travel ban, the policy could have a direct effect on your health. The ban is on hold for the moment, but it's put a spotlight on doctors in the U.S. who hold foreign passports. As KERA's Lauren Silverman reports, these physicians often serve in areas where there aren't enough doctors.
Patients at Christus Pediatrics in Alexandria, Louisiana, were some of the friendliest people Dr. Mohamed Tassif ever worked with. They'd drive long distances to see him and often bring gifts.
It's a small town, so they will sometimes bring your chicken, bring the eggs, bring the homemade cakes.
One woman even brought him a puppy.
That was really nice.
Tassif is from Pakistan. After going to a top medical school there, he applied to come to the U.S. to train as a pediatrician. It's a path thousands of foreign-born medical students follow every year, a path that's been around for more than a half century. And like most foreign-born physicians, Tassif came on a J-1 visa. That meant after training, he had two options: return to Pakistan or work for 3 years in an area the government has identified as having a provider shortage. He chose to work with mostly uninsured kids in Alexandria, Louisiana.
That was a challenge, but on a personal level, it was rewarding as well, that you are taking care of people who there aren't many to take care for.
International medical graduates have been a resource to provide medical care to areas that don't otherwise have access to physicians.
Andrew Gurman is president of the American Medical Association. He says the U.S. has a persistent primary care shortage, particularly in rural areas.
With the current uncertainty about those physicians' immigration status, we don't know whether or not these areas are going to receive care.
And the care is top-notch. A study just published in the journal BMJ shows Medicare patients treated by doctors from foreign medical schools get just as good care, and sometimes better, than those treated by U.S. medical graduates. Today, there are about 280,000 international medical graduates in the U.S., and about one in four doctors practicing here. Some are U.S. citizens who've gone abroad for medical school, but most aren't.
They don't all have permanent visas, so a lot of them are concerned about what their status is going to be, whether they can stay, whether they can go home to visit family and still come back. And the communities that they serve have similar questions.
The uncertainty is hitting medical schools at a tough time. Dr. Salahuddin Qazi is in charge of recruiting top students from across the world for the University of Texas Southwestern's residency program.
Typically, we have 3,000 people applying for our 61 positions. Of those 3,000, at least half of them are international medical graduates.
Applicants find out their program match in March and start working in June. That gives them about 90 days to get a visa. Qazi worries this year that won't be long enough and that students from countries included in the travel ban won't be let in.
And that, you know, would create hardship for the hospital, for us, and for our remaining residents.
Patients here at Los Barrios Unidos Community Clinic in Dallas rely on foreign-born doctors. Remember pediatrician Dr. Tosif? After he left Louisiana, he got a job here.
So this is our pediatric building that we're entering.
Six of the 30 physicians who work at this clinic are from other countries. Tosif says they're all educated to do the same thing.
As a physician, being a foreign medical graduate, U.S. medical graduate, a Muslim doctor, a non-Muslim, we are trained to look for signs and symptoms. We do not look at anybody's color. We are not trained to look at anybody's religion or ethnicity.
Tosif, who's been in America for 13 years, will apply for U.S. citizenship next month. For Fronteras, I'm Lauren Silverman.
Coming up on Fronteras, young immigrants who currently have deportation relief worry that it won't last long. We'll explore that story when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. 2 years ago, Ana Zamora was on top of the world. She'd written a letter to President Obama, who invited her to his State of the Union address. Here's what she told KERA in 2015.
And in the letter, I expressed my story and what I expected from the future and how grateful I was to be a recipient of DACA.
DACA is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. President Obama created it in 2012 to allow undocumented immigrants who entered the U.S. as minors to remain in the country. Last fall, while Donald Trump was running for president, he vowed to end the program. On Tuesday, President Trump declared that DACA protections would remain in place, though many undocumented immigrants are taking this assurance with a grain of salt. As KERA's Gus Contreras reports, confusion over immigration policy leaves people like Ana Zamora in limbo.
Ana Zamora spent the last 2 years teaching kindergarten at Uplift Triumph Prep, a charter school near Love Field.
If you're at 8, how many more do you need to get to 10? Yes, Mia?
Two more.
Two more. Because everybody show me 8 fingers.
And despite having a work permit in the U.S. until 2018, she's feeling a little shaky.
If you put yourself in my place, this is exactly how I feel. You're just like walking and you don't know when you're going to fall.
750,000 young unauthorized immigrants have gotten work permits and deportation relief through the DACA program. Zamora's been a recipient since it was created in 2012 and has to reapply every other year. Candidate Donald Trump had some pretty strong words about the so-called dreamers, like Zamora during the campaign last fall.
I want dreamers to come from the United States. I want the people in the United States that have children. I want them to have dreams also. We're always talking about dreamers for other people. I want the children that are growing up in the United States to be dreamers also. They're not dreaming right now.
In a press conference last week, President Trump hit a different note.
We are going to deal with DACA with heart. I have to deal with a lot of politicians, don't forget. And I have to convince them that what I'm saying is right.
Trump sparked protests at airports in Texas and across the country last month with executive orders that target refugees and travel, not DACA. Still, Zamora's looking for something a little more stable.
Throughout time, we have seen that it was only a Band-Aid. And so currently right now, I feel like many people don't feel safe because DACA is just a permit for you to be able to work. You're not legally here, and it can be taken away at any moment.
The term dreamer comes from the DREAM Act, first proposed in Congress a decade and a half ago, but never passed. A bipartisan group in Washington is now behind what's known as the Bridge Act. It would give people like Zamora 3 years of deportation relief and permission to work. Even though Republican senators like Lindsey Graham and Jeff Flake have signed on, Lisa Garcia Bedoya doesn't hold out much hope. She's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who specializes in race, gender, and class.
I think the chances are low, but I think the fact that the chances are low really speaks to how much the context of immigration policy has changed, and the fact that we are at a place where just the extension of DACA, which is less than the DREAM Act, right, in the sense that it does not allow a true path for legalization for these individuals, the fact that even that has no likelihood of passing in the House of Representatives really speaks to how far we've come on this issue.
Zamora's come a long way, too. She was a toddler when her parents left San Luis Potosí, Mexico, for Dallas. Her two younger siblings were born here, leaving her as the family's outlier.
I never made a decision to come to the United States. It was my parents' decision, and so sometimes we're blamed for that, but really we're just here, and we've served so much to the United States, and the United States has given to us as well. And so for us, I feel like we are Americans, and so we don't see it another way.
And even though she says it's hard to plan anything beyond the next 2 years, she still holds on to the hope of a green card. Gus Contreras, KERA News.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.